On Surfing the Quicksand, I love that I get to talk to a lot of people who have found their voice in midlife. And these are women who have found their voice and started listening to their voice and starting sharing their voice, maybe in some surprising ways. My guest today, Angela Burke, is an author of The Real Girl's Guide to Midlife. And boy, is it a way that this woman who has gone through a ton of reflection and shifting and change and heartbreak and sorrow and struggles came to find what it is she wanted to share with all the women around her in this kind of bare all, tell all, very funny, very poignant memoir. I'm excited to introduce you to her, not only to learn more about her story, but how the process of bringing this book to life really impacted how she feels about herself today and where the future might take her. Welcome to Surfing the Quicksand. I'm your host, Kathy Vines. You've already come to know that one of the things I love about Surfing the Quicksand is bringing some inspirational stories of women who, during midlife, have really recharted where they're going and reframing how where they've been serves their future. And today I'm introducing you to Angela Burke. She is someone who, after a very extensive and successful career, marketing leader for tech, taking multiple companies from like pre-IPO life all the way to Fortune 500 companies, said goodbye to that life. And in the process of exploring midlife, has found her voice, embraced her voice, and is shouting from the rooftops with it. She has a very successful Substack, but what has really caught the attention of many midlife women now is her new book, The Real Girl's Guide to Midlife. And I find it to be a heartwarming, real, relatable, and funny memoir and manifesto combination. And I'm excited to talk with her and introduce you to Angela so we can learn more about how she got here and what she's doing with that voice. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you for having me. That was such a great opening.
Good. I like I said, I've read the book. There's so much about it I love, and I can't wait to get into it. But I want to start with kind of the before midlife, where you were. I know your story involves your corporate journey. I want to talk about that and marriage and divorce and new love and parenting and so much. So let's start with the corporate story, since that's so much about changing your purpose professionally here. Tell me a bit about your corporate journey and how you got to right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I started working in marketing right after college. Actually, my first marketing job was my senior year in college. One of my professors raised his kind of opened the class and said, "Hey, my wife is looking for a marketing research assistant. Is anybody interested?" And what was interesting, and now that I reflect back on that story, I held back. I was, he was looking for somebody to raise their hand at the start of class, and I looked around, and I was like, "Oh, I shouldn't do that." And I held back, I reserved, and I waited until the end of class. And then I actually sat in my seat waiting for people to go kind of bombard him with interest, and nobody did. So then I felt comfortable and I was like, "Okay, I'm going to go do this." And so that was kind of the start. And it's funny, just having even reflected on that story as I was writing the book, it sort of was a good example of how I lived a lot of my life. And so that was my first marketing job. And I held a lot of different marketing jobs through the course of my career. And it was a 30-year career. And I'm still doing marketing now. And what I realized about that career is I'm really capable. And I think, my capability became my currency. And, I am the person that executives would turn to build things that had never been built before, to fix things that were broken, and to solve really hard problems. And that, I kept myself comfortable in a lot of those instances, but also became wildly uncomfortable in a lot of them, because I stretched myself. And I became much more comfortable with the idea of stretching myself as I got more advanced in my career and had more, longevity on this earth. But it was a really, it was a fruitful career. It was highly stressful. You talked about the different size companies. And, I look back now And I'm really proud of that career. And a lot of the stories that I told myself or others told about me during that career were patently false. And it was when I transitioned out of working full time, retired in 24, and started consulting that I realized I know a lot of stuff. And people want to know what I know. And the truth is, I always did.
I love so much of that, and we're about the same age, and so to be able to kind of hear your story and kind of listen in my own head to my similar trajectory and coming out of grad school and going after some opportunities, maybe with some hesitation, like you couldn't possibly mean me, right? And I was one of those people who got to a point in my career in my 20s where, especially my first job, I got to a point where I said, "Am I only good? It's the only thing I'm good at working here. Like, I've just been good at this environment and this ecosystem and these politics." And every time I went to a new place, it felt like a test. Like, maybe I'm just full of it. Maybe I've only gotten good at not manipulating, but like succeeding in a very set path. And it took decades to be like, "Oh, wait, no, this is me, and this is what I'm bringing with me. I am the embodiment of what I've built and what I'm known for and what people seek me out for."
It's such a good point. And I think for me, another layer to that was this idea that, not only did I tell myself, and I wrote a lot of stories about myself in almost all facets of my life. Some of them were true and some of them were modeled for me. Some of them were very untrue. Some of them were things that I wanted not to be true, but I fought so hard against that tide. But from a career standpoint, I led a lot of storylines that sounded like, she's an execution machine. She's not strategic. She's not visible to the right executives. Sort of play. They were the soundtrack in my head that either prevented me from, taking new opportunities or putting myself in the running for new opportunities, or somehow diminished the value that I was delivering to an organization, or somehow justified why shouldn't I have a bigger title? Why shouldn't I have more pay? And what I realized was those things were not, I am an execution machine and I am strategic. And one of the reasons why I wasn't always visible to the quote unquote right execs was that my work was never a problem. You know what I mean? So in my environment, you work at high tech, you work in these really fast growth companies. A lot of times executives get hyper focused on things that are broken, right? And so if your area of the business is not broken, and it's swimming along, you might get some attention, but you're not going to get the hyper focus. The being asked to come to meetings on a weekly, sometimes more than once a week basis, the executives digging into every nuance and every detail of your work. When your stuff is working and running as it should, a lot of times executives just go, great, that's one less thing I have to worry, one less problem I have to face right now. And so in my head, though, I let those things sort of limit me. I let those things justify why I was maybe being a little bit more timid, why I was sort of playing small and shrinking and, and they weren't true.
I think what you're describing comes to mind for me as I, in my career coaching business and in my HR career, right? Always when I work with women, again, especially kind of in a Gen X or older millennial space, who believe I shouldn't have to advocate for myself and draw attention to myself. My work should speak for itself. And I think so many women are really invested in that part of their pride of what they've accomplished and what they've done. But I think you've really highlighted, well, there's a downside to thinking that, right? Which is you're not going to get the intention unless you seek it out and demand it. And really, we talk about it. Gosh, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. That kind of that perspective. When we are more invested in that execution machine and being solid and saying like, "Oh, my job is to make sure everything goes smoothly." If we're in an environment where that's not recognized or rewarded or shouted from the rooftops, we have a disconnect with the success that we get and that we feel.
Absolutely. And I also think it limits our view of the possibilities, right? Like for me, the way that showed up, I heard this echoed in some of the women that I also talked to for the book from a career standpoint. How that shows up in some cases is it limits your aperture or putting yourself into the running for different jobs. It limits your aperture for looking at opportunities that are maybe a step or two above where you are. For me, that's what it did. I would always seek out the work that needed fixing, the problems that needed a solution, because I was good at that. But what I often would sort of find myself kind of pulling back the edges on would be, a job opportunity that was a level or two above where I was today, because I sort of let some of these stories sort of limit what I thought was possible and how far I was really willing to stretch. And so I think that that's kind of the other danger of that is you sort of put these limits on yourself that are they're self-induced.
I want to shift a little to your personal life, because I feel
Yes.
like since I know a bit about your story, there's an echoing there.
Yes,
walk me through that.
Yeah. So from a personal standpoint, I was raised one of four kids. I have two half sisters who are much younger than me, and I have a brother. I was a little bit later in life to find my partner and my ex-husband. We got married. I was in my early 30s, had three kids, three boys, during the course of my 15-year marriage. What's interesting about that is, if I look back and, the role that I played in my family was always, and to some degree still is, the one who was like the peacekeeper. I was the people pleaser. I did not want to make waves. I was steady. I was safe. I was quiet. I was calm. And I provided that, I think, to a lot of people around me. And, you fast forward when that's the storyline, that's the model, that's the behavior that became my MO, it showed up. It not only shows up in work, it not only shows up in the way I mother, it shows up in personal relationships. And so, I started to recognize that, particularly, it's probably started when I was in my mid-30s. So many transitions were happening, and for us women in our mid-30s, a lot of stuff is happening. For me, it was like career crossroads. I had two kids at that time, contemplating a third. I didn't realize that my hormones were already starting to change, but my cycles they looked different. When I was in my mid-30s, my appearance looked different. Nothing tragic, but things were shifting. And I was looking around and I was like, man, everybody seems to have their stuff together. It's got to just be me. I must be the crazy one. It's all in my head. I'm the one that's losing my mind. Like, everybody else is good. So okay, Angela, just suck it up. And how that also played out though in, my personal life and my marriage was I was so I white knuckled everything during that time, right? I white knuckled the relationship. I white knuckled, trying to be the best at my career, the best mom, the best daughter, the best friend, everything. And I was just exhausted. But I also realized that I tried so hard, particularly when I look at my marriage and my family. I wanted so badly to give my, come to be three boys, an intact family, but I was losing myself. I did not recognize the parts of me that were the best parts of me. And I started to feel like I was drifting closer to the edges of my own life. And I was like, why am I holding on and trying to focus so much on giving my kids this intact family when they're not seeing a happy mom? They're not seeing a happy Angela. And the trade-off was just too great. And so that shift for me started in my 30s. And it kind of took me into my 40s. And that was probably, somebody asked me the other day, what has been the most challenging decade for you? I said, well, honestly, they're all challenging in a different way. But my 40s was the decade that I went through the most amount of change, I think, and the most amount of reckoning, and this most amount of reintroducing myself to myself. And thankfully, it's carried into my 50s, because now, so far, my 50s is sort of in a lot of ways, some of the best years so far because of that shift.
I think it's an interesting question about the decades, and it's purely rearview mirror, right? In your 40s, you're just balancing what's coming. You have no idea what's still to come. No. Forget about what's potential, right? Like, everybody can say It is possible. I have a marriage. It is possible a marriage ends, right? Those kinds of
Right.
things. Or menopause is coming, or I may lose a parent. I may lose other people in our lives. But to see when we look back, like, oh my gosh, look at everything I faced during that era. And what can I see that I grew from it, where I had gains, where I had losses, where I had losses I'm willing to write off, right? Like,
Oh,
a
yeah.
loss, but like I'm good with that, right? That ability to look at a whole decade is a gift of itself, right?
Oh,
But to
yeah.
be in mid-50s and say, so far 50s are looking great, and I'm definitely cognizant I have no idea what's coming. Right? Like, we
Absolutely.
still to be written.
Absolutely.
I want to go back to kind of the point around this the intact, like, desperate to kind of keep the intact family for your children. I had another episode where I brought on a family law attorney around kind of embracing kind of the gray divorce and Meno divorce, and that one of the calls to action as a woman and as a responsible parent is like, what are you teaching your children to say, I'm willing to stick in something horrible for 50 years because I value what I think on paper is an important thing I bring, right? I'm that a mother delivers that to their children. Can you kind of reflect on that struggle you talked about with that intact family promise or commitment and how you undid it?
Well, I think the commitment, like for many of us, the beliefs we hold, the stories we tell ourselves, the things that we imagine are deeply rooted, right? And for me, a lot of those things were rooted in this idea. Again, I kind of come back to, I am the steady one. I am the safe one. I am the stable one. And I was almost, I somehow needed to get permission to do things in my own life, to kind of be my own person. And for me, a lot of that was, I sort of believed that it was my job as a mom. It was my job as a wife to sort of contort myself in order to make everybody else comfortable and happy and feel safe, right? That's what I thought I was supposed to do. And it was rooted in, I think, a lot of these beliefs and stories that I had, modeled for me and held on so deeply and so tightly for most of my life. So to me, it was that idea that I was wrong for wanting more. Somehow that my happiness should not come first on the list, because if my happiness comes first, it's at the expense of other people's. How do I justify that? So I, the story sort of played out in these beliefs that, hey, I was wrong to want more, whether that showed up in pleasure, relationships, jobs, whatever. My happiness could not come first on the list, because if it did, it meant somebody else was going to suffer. So how do I do that? How do I justify that in my head? And so that's, I think, the view that sort of held me. And it wasn't like, I look back at that time and, it was fine. It wasn't dramatic. It wasn't, wildly, on either extreme, really good or really bad. It just was, but it wasn't enough. And so I also had to kind of replay this idea that it was okay to want more. It was okay to be dissatisfied. It was okay to believe that there was more. And to the point of what you talked about modeling for the kids, I realized I had to do that, right? I didn't want my boys to see that being okay was sufficient. That this idea that somehow I could be happier or their dad could be happier in another situation was sufficient, and we should just suck it up. That was not okay. And so a lot of these deeply rooted beliefs and things I wanted to impart on my kids couldn't just be me telling them, right? They had to see me doing it. And I also realized that, until that point, my kids didn't really know me, because I didn't really know myself, and they didn't see me truly happy. They didn't see the best parts of me, because I had kind of let those go for a while, and that's what they deserved. And I deserved it, not because they deserved it, because I deserved it, and I wanted them to see that too.
So you have this kind of awakening in terms of your marriage and what do you want from there. And I deserve more, and I deserve the strength that it takes to ask for more. And you also have this shifting going on in your corporate career, like overlapping a little. How do you, what comes about for you that allows you to grab the reins differently in your life and start to make this shift?
Well, and so here's the thing. If I go back, like let's just kind of center on that time. You talked about two big things that were happening, right? My career at that point, I was working a job that was super stressful. I was putting in 12, 13, 14-hour days on the regular. I had this, this realization that, hey, the marriage is not going to be the way I need it to be. I'm now forging a different, all the things that I thought were going to be my future, the family, quote unquote, that I designed in my head was going to change. That was terrifying. I'm now having to forge a life as a single mother. Like, look, my kid's dad is still around, but you are now a single person parenting these kids. Plus, I had the backdrop of all the hormone stuff, which in my mid-40s, I had no idea how close I was to actually becoming postmenopausal. So all these things were sort of piling on me at one time, right? And so it wasn't like this big light bulb moment where I woke up one day and was just like, enough, right? It was just as insidious is the process of these little stories and the fact that, like, hey, I was not recognizing myself. Hey, I felt like I could be happier. Hey, I had to tell myself I was not wrong for wanting more. Hey, I can't even recognize myself. It's a process, right? And it's not this one big like light bulb moment. It was the same on sort of building the confidence that I had to start making changes. And it's not like I did them all at once, but one small realization that for me it was, I thought it. And then I had to say it out loud to myself. I am not happy. I want something different. And then that started the movement. And the movement was small, the movement was gradual, but it became the way I looked at everything in my life. And so I think, sorry, you'll have to forgive me. This menopause stuff with the dryness. Nobody tells you that, 8 years past, you still have symptoms, and the new one is dryness. Everything itches all the time. But the subtle changes that I began to make, they started the train, and then it built my confidence. And I started tapping into the things that I was feeling and the things that I was seeing when I just observed everything around me. And I'm like, I'm not satisfied. I need to make a change. And whether that was work, my relationship, the things about my physical body that were changing, and that were a lot of them still are. And it forced me to acknowledge those things and go, how do I feel about them? And then what am I going to do now?
I want to talk about the body for a second,
Yeah.
right? You
Okay.
mentioned menopause and dryness, and
Yeah.
I smile because like my
Oh,
ears, I'm
I
wearing these, and
just,
like my ears, like why do you
why?
why do my ears
Why?
feel like this? So you kind of talked about, gosh, you were really in your 40s starting with perimenopausal symptoms, and I think I will say this on every episode where it's relevant. We are so lucky that we are the first generation to have social media before, during, and after menopause comes around, and our ability to kind of relate and share and do it without shame. And there's so much we are in that sense the luckiest generation. That said, we also have a very sometimes problematic healthcare system here in the United States about it. We've got decades that were closed off in terms of hormone therapy, and we've got a reawakening, we hope, around that. When you think about where you were as all of this was going on, again, we're going back probably 10 years. What was your reality and awareness and support looking like as you navigated the body changes?
Okay, that's a really good question. I didn't have a lot, So if, take just the hormone stuff, right? At that point, you go back 10, and for me, it was probably more like 15 years ago when I was really in the thick of things were just changing. I had just had my third baby, wrote off a lot of the cycle changes to, hey, I'm still recovering from having given birth, I'm nursing, all the things. But my stuff started really early. And honestly, I did not even understand what perimenopause was. It was not something we talked about. And I'm super close to my mom. My mom and I are 19 years apart. So I remember, so I was old enough to remember her going through, quote unquote, the change. That's the language that I had, right? It was the change. My mom went through it. My grandma went through it. That was all about the time of the World Health Initiative study. We don't do hormones. And so a lot of these things, I didn't have the language. And what I was going through was not what it looked like from my vantage point, what my mom went through. And none of my friends were talking about it. So I'm like literally every day kind of going, okay, it must be me. I'm the crazy one. I got to be the only one suffering with this stuff. But I didn't have a language and I didn't even know what to look for. And so the doctor's appointments were not even ones where I came like kind of somewhat educated. I didn't. And that's kind of where a lot of us were at that time. So the lack of support was just because I didn't know. And I was looking around to my peer group. I'm looking around and like nobody seems to be suffering in the same ways I am. So it's like, well, it must just be me. And so you kind of fast forward into my mid-40s when again, I didn't realize I was about 2 years from completing that 12-month magical period without having a period. I was, because I didn't know how close I was. But I go back to that time and think about what was happening. I was divorcing. I was in this really high pressure job. I'm trying desperately to create a situation for my boys that was as smooth of a transition for them as I could. I had the backdrop of all the hormone stuff. I'm kind of now reintroducing myself to myself in a lot of ways. And man, I did not show up well to my kids. They saw the worst parts of me. They saw the rage. And it wasn't like, again, anything that was like abusive or dramatic, but it was just, I look back at that time and I was like, man, I'm really sorry, my little dudes. I'm really sorry because I didn't know what was happening. And it was so easy for me to write it off to, well, yeah, no wonder why you're so tired. No wonder why you're raging. You're terrified. You're scary. You're embarking on this new life. You're letting go. You're grieving the family that you thought you were going to have. You're rewriting a future that looks terrifying because there's so many unknowns. And so I was dealing with all of that. And then you have the emotional backdrop of excitement, absolute fear, shame. I was feeling guilty. I was embarrassed. It was all these things. And I was not equipped to sort of rationalize, okay, this is what's happening. This is why it's happening. Because I was in it. And so did I have support? Sure. I had a support system around me, but I didn't have the language and I didn't have the ability to kind of tie it together in a way that made sense. And I didn't have grace really for myself.
Grace is entirely the word that was coming to mind to me as you were talking of like, oh my gosh, how we don't give ourselves grace. And we are quick to give grace or encourage grace to those people around us that we love. But to see it in ourselves and to give it to ourselves is, it's like, well, no, I need to hold myself accountable because, hey, I just gave you a full menu of all the ways in which I'm not showing up on my A game, not even a B game. And how could I possibly give myself grace knowing that I'm not showing up in the world that in a way that I'm proud of? And then I'm going to look back and say, oh, yeah, I did right by these people that during that time.
And that's, I think, there's this phrase like leave the stick at the door. I didn't, so there was a lot of, if I look back at that, again, like you said, the rear view is always really clear. But looking back at that time, I was really hard on myself. And so, and part of it because I didn't have the language, I didn't have models around me. Everybody's life just looked like super shiny, right? Like, okay, yeah, maybe people were going through hard times. So you saw the before and then you saw the after. What about all that messiness in the middle, folks? It's like, am I the only one that's dealing with this?
I think that while I just extol the virtue of it's so great that we've had social media during this time frame because it has helped us all learn and share and grow, that is of course one of the drastic negatives of the, social media really just ignores the middles and it not only ignores the middles but makes it easy for us to make sure we ignore the middles.
Oh, absolutely. And that was the hard stuff. And that's, if I'm honest with you, so this book idea actually was one that I had when I was 35. So it was going to be called The Real Girl's Guide to Over 35. And why? Because again, I was looking around, I was at these crossroads, career, new family, a marriage. My appearance was starting to change. I didn't know it at the time. My hormones were starting to change. And nobody was talking. So you go back 20 years now. So I don't even know, like, was social media a thing? No, I don't like to, I remember having email, but like I don't think we had Facebook. I don't think we had anything. So I'm looking around and I'm like, everybody seems to have everything together. Everybody's shiny and they're showing up great at work. And, these power moms at the school, and everybody's like, everything just looks so great. Now I'm like coming crumpled. Like I felt like I was just crumpled. And so I started to write these questions and these observations, and I put it all into a red folder. It was literally, do you remember those old-fashioned like file folders?
I still use them, yes.
Me too. So I put everything into a red folder, and I had this idea. I wanted to share my questions. I wanted to get advice and stories from other women, and then I wanted to get expert points of view. And then the folder got buried, literally and figuratively. And so when I retired in December of 24, I was cleaning out a really small pile on my desk, and I found the folder. And I opened the folder, and I was like, look at that. A lot of the same things that I was plagued with then, still am. Some of them I've kind of worked through. Cool, like A for effort on that. And then there's a whole new host of things that were just baffling me. And so, I gave myself a couple months to ask the question, like, oh, can I write this book? Should I write this book? Who am I to think I can? And then I quickly, thank God, I short-circuited that old talk train and got to stop it. It's not why me, why should I, blah, blah, blah. It's why the heck not? And so that's what I did. So then I wrote the
So first of all, the professional organizer in me loves that you're decluttering,
book.
uncovered some treasure. That's amazing. And I used to, when I was in the corporate world, I had a bright orange folder that went with me with every job, which was like my most important thing. And on the outside, I wrote, "For the love of all things holy, do this right now." Right?
Love
It
it.
was like I know the kind of that physical touchstone to say this is important stuff. So to know that you had that in that red folder that I got put aside for a while, and then uncovered in an archaeological dig of your corporate life, to suddenly then say, oh, wait a minute, if I were to try this back on today, how does it fit today? What needs to change? How does it alter? And then how do I show up in it now? So writing the book was not something you th was on your mind like the day before you found this folder.
Oh, no, not at all. And I'm not a writer. So I'm a career marketer. And of course, like, a lot of the marketing jobs I had had a content development component to them for sure. But no, the book idea was always like there. I know I didn't forget, like my memory is really bad, but I remembered that I had this idea for a book, right? But it was always at the back of my mind. And so finding the folder, I was like, okay, look at this. So I had to sit with it. And ask myself a lot of the questions: can I, should I, who am I to think? And again, at this point in my mid-50s, it's not to say that I'm perfect, that I've lost all the old scripts entirely, that I never fall into this like people-pleasing self-doubt, because I do, I'm human. But I can short-circuit it so much better now. And a lot of times I can spot it before it even starts, because the mindset and the behavior shift is so ingrained now, and I love that. But in this case, I had to sit with it. And then in April of 25, I was like, okay, I'm gonna do it. And I'm like, wow, what exactly am I gonna do, and how am I gonna start it? So I just started. And I had some I quickly learned a couple of things about myself. Number one, I had to write for 45 minutes at a time. And I started with writing for 45 minutes a day. And so I kind of had this general structure for the book. I talked with kind of a writing coach. I had a few sessions with him, because all I needed was somebody to help me organize the structure, right? And so he did that. And I realized as I started writing, 45 minutes a day was all I could do. And then it turned into it, when I was in my most creative, it was I might have two or three different sessions in a day, but always 45 minutes. And here's why. For me, anything longer than 45 minutes, I would go back and I would reread, and I had the inclination to edit. And it would be things like, ooh, I can't say that. I can't talk about that subject. Or how is somebody going to feel reading something that I just wrote? Like I had this pull to start softening things. And I'm like, nope, not going to do it. I spent decades of my life softening my views, my opinions, my desires, my wants, my own voice. I am not going to do it in my writing. So anything longer than 45 minutes, I would feel this like immediate pull to go back and like start to edit. And I'm like, nope, not going to do it. So that was the discipline. And then kind of fast forward a couple months, I thought somebody said, oh, you should start a Substack. And I was like, oh yeah, what's that? So I dug in and I was like, okay, like, cool, let me try that. And it was really in my head, I had no like grand plan. I had no like well thought out strategy other than this is a good place to at least test my writing, you know, and maybe see if it even is resonating. But even with the process of starting the book, I had a couple of clear objectives. Number one, I wanted to finish what I start. That's one of the things I tell my kids. We finish what we start. Number two, one of the things I also tell my kids is if you're going to take a risk in life, always bet on yourself. This was super risky, right? And then number three, you know, this was not a money-making endeavor. And I said, if only three people buy the book, me, my mother, and my 82-year-old aunt, I would call that a success. And so that was the strategy. But the Substack just kind of was like, oh, I like, let's just see what's landing. Like, and does my voice even resonate? So that was kind of the process. And then the other objective I had was I wanted my book to be published within 1 year of my retirement. And when I was talking to somebody about this early on, they're like, oh, that's so cute. You'll be lucky if you get your manuscript done by the end of December. And I, or by middle of December of 25. And I was like, you don't know me. So that was the challenge. It was like, you're going to underestimate me. You're going to tell me I'm lucky if that's done. Oh, just watch. And so I'm happy to say that the manuscript was done in July. I sent out book proposals. I got a couple of bites, but nothing that was appealing to me. I made the decision to self-publish in August. And on December 10th, my book launched, which happened to be the day that I retired the year before. So, you know, and I did have to do a little subtle dig to that person who, like, oh, I'm sorry, what did you say about the manuscript maybe
They
being done in December?
were they in your acknowledgments, special
No,
thanks to so and
no,
so to prompt me to
no,
get
no,
this.
no, they weren't. But it was, I had all the like everything I needed to be able to go back to that person. I was like, this is so good. This is so good.
I there's so much about what you just shared. I love the kind of betting on yourself, right? And I think that there is something that is so powerful in recognizing that there's two parts of that. One is that you are in control of who you bet on, and number two is that you are deserving of that wager, right? There's two stories there. But I think as somebody who also wrote a book and did it within a year and faced similar decisions and points and the process and why me and who would even read this and what does success look like, right? When you're writing a book, especially if you're gonna independently publish, right? It's like, how am I gonna evaluate success? There's a lot in putting your voice out there. And once you're done, you get it out there and like, well,
See what happens.
See if anybody cares or if it resonates or if somebody wants me on their podcast, whatever that is. When you think about your kind of that rush to the that one year and getting it out there, what was behind that for you to say, I want it done within a year, right? It's somewhat arbitrary, yet it clearly ignited passion for you.
You know, it's so funny. I don't know that there was any, it's just because it's something that I wanted. I wanted to be able to say to myself, look what I did. You know, because I think there's a couple things that happened. So not only, so when you go back to December of 24, I retired, right? So I got the gift of retirement, which was great. I was retired all of a month because then I started to connect with people that I'd worked with in the past and got invited to do things like advising and consulting and fractional work. So I really was retired for like 5 minutes. And that was actually a very conscious decision. And it also reaffirmed, turns out, all the things that, you know, these stories that other people wrote about me and that I told about myself during my career were just not true because I knew a lot. I was very, very comfortable advising on domains inside marketing that I had never led or ran. And people wanted to know what I knew. And they're willing to pay for it. And so that was so reaffirming, right? That I was, I almost fell into it immediately. And then when I started writing, though, I sort of wanted to be able to say to myself, look at what I've done, because I always had it in me. So I picked that within 12 months of my retirement. It was totally arbitrary. But it was something I wanted. I wanted to be able to say to myself, not to anybody else, to myself, look what I did. And not because, like, oh, look what I found. It's, I always was able to, like, this is within me to control. And I was never so, like, hard and fast about this deadline. But as I got closer, because the self-publishing world is like, that's a whole other, like, bag of tricks. Turns out 30 years of marketing does not buy you a lot when you self-publish, but, like, that's another story. But there were points as I got kind of into the sort of summer and fall of that year where I was like, okay, like, Angela, like, give yourself a break here. Like, you know, just it, if it doesn't happen at this timeline, it's okay. And I was like, no, it's not. So it was both arbitrary, but it was also attainable, and it was a stretch. And it was the thing that kind of pushed me in the times where I was like, okay, I'm so overwhelmed, or like, why am I pushing so hard? It was like, because this is the commitment I made to myself. This was something, the challenge I challenged myself, and I was not going to let myself down.
I also, as somebody who left the corporate world and said, I'm doing my own thing, I know that I really struggled with, I used to be accountable to a lot of other people for what I do and what I put out there in the world and how I show up and the timelines and all of that. And so the idea of having a goal very early on upon that was important to me because it was anchoring. Right. It was like, oh, how do I transition from that world to I don't even know what, but there I have this project and this project feels important to complete, if only to prove to myself that I can do things on my terms and in my vision and with my skills and passion. Again, regardless of whether or not it lands with everybody else, I know it's been important to me to define where this path goes.
And I think what you said is about being accountable to yourself, and a lot of that is rooted, you know, and as I built the book, you know, I kind of adhered to the structure that I had, you know, designed 20 years prior. My stories, I was so incredibly humbled to have so many women willing to share their stories, and even more humbled that experts were willing to talk to me, like, what? And we could talk about that process in a minute, but the other thing that it reinforced for me was this belief that what I wanted, whether that was what I wanted in my personal life, what I wanted in my professional life, what I wanted in terms of my relationship with pleasure, whatever it was, I was okay to want that, and it had to come first. So the idea of being accountable to myself, and that was a little bit of a mindset shift, but it came through all of this unraveling and these unlearnings that I was going through, right? That it was okay to want that. I could challenge myself. I could do this just for me, you know? And I didn't have to prove it to anybody else, but I get to come first. And so it was a little bit of a switch to that, right? Like, yeah, I wanted to be accountable and I wanted to have a deadline, but also I deserved it. And I was strong enough, and I had enough confidence in myself to know that I would get it done, not for anybody else, but for me.
I think what you're talking about, it brings me to the book, right? Which is almost every chapter is, it comes across as how you've reclaimed aspects of your life, whether it is, again, professional, how you're framing your professional experience, your former marriage, you found love again in a unique and you have a unique relationship now, changing through parenting, from parenting younger kids to parenting emerging adults, grief, sexuality, relationships and friendships, so many different things around saying, no, I'm looking at my life with today's eyes and today's growth and some grace to say, this is what I've built. This is where I've screwed up and I'm taking ownership on that. And this is how I'm committing to my future differently, chapter after chapter after chapter.
I mean, I think one of the things with that too is, you do have to get humble and you have to kind of get real. And so that's, I think, the backdrop of all the writing on all the topics was about me sort of peeling back, the shame, the guilt, the sorrow, the sadness, the frustration, all the things, and just going, okay, this is all the real stuff. And it also was a little bit of this idea that somehow I wish I would have given myself that grace 20 years ago, 10 years ago. I wish I would have been able to say at that time, you know what? You're not crazy for wanting more. You're not cracking. You're not losing it. And you're enough. You're just enough. Because I always was. And I think it took the process of even writing for me to really believe and embrace and give myself the ability to look back at that time and go, yeah, like, was it perfect? No, but man, you weren't cracking. You weren't crazy. And you were enough. You are enough. You always were. Like, and that was it was a gift I gave to myself, actually, through that process.
You know what I like about this idea is not just, hey, Angela's a capable, confident woman and she wrote a book and people should read it. It's also through an act of creativity, we can reflect and heal and forgive ourselves sometimes, right? Like what, how powerful just engaging in creativity can be.
It's very true. And it's funny because my brother is an artist. So I have a brother who's an artist. One of my sons is very talented. He's very talented in the arts and fashion design. He's just super very creative. And he and I were talking at the start of this book, and I was like, yeah, you and your uncle got the creative genes. He's like, what are you talking about? I was like, well, what do you mean? What am I talking about? You guys are the artists. You're the ones who can see like the most amazing things in your world, and you can spot richness and colors and all these things. He's like, Mom, you're writing. That's creative. And I was like, oh yeah, look at that. You're right. But I didn't even key into that really until I was in the process of writing the book. Like, it never occurred to me to think that writing, and I think because even when I started the process, it was so personal. It was something that was so in me. And how could something in me be creative? It was like, oh. But it was an interesting kind of perspective that he shed. And I was like, oh, you know what? You're right. And it's funny how I needed the 22-year-old to kind of point that out to his old mom.
Well, and it's also breaking those old tapes, right? You told yourself, I'm not creative, especially because I know who is, and they are, and I am not. And to be able to not even look at evidence staring you in the face 45 minutes a day, proving otherwise.
It's so wild. It's so wild. Yeah, the tapes are really strong, aren't they?
They are. And you know, I often reflect on how throughout my HR career, right, I would often talk, we would have performance conversations and I'd be working with managers on difficult things and I would bring up old tapes and I often wonder about, gosh, if I were still in corporate HR today and talking with the younger generations and saying old tapes, would they even understand what I'm trying to conjure up by
They'd
that
be like,
metaphor?
what is a
Like,
tape? What is this tape you
what?
speak of?
Like, no. Listen, I want to switch to the quicksand three, which are three questions that I ask everybody. And then we're going to come back and I want you to tell people more about how to find your book, your Substack, understand more about just learning more about you and your creativity.
My creativity.
Good. Okay. So first question, what is a way that you get yourself unstuck and motivated to do something that you've been procrastinating and avoiding?
Actually, it starts with me saying the thing out loud. Like, and sometimes it's even just to myself. I wanted to clean out my pantry for a long time, and I thought it a lot. I would walk by the pantry, I'd get so frustrated when I was standing in it. I couldn't find what I wanted, and I just thought it looked like crap. And so one day I just said out loud to myself, by myself, I'm cleaning out the pantry. I'm done with this. And so for me, it starts with saying the thing I want or I need or I feel like I want to do out loud to myself. And that interrupts the pattern of thinking that it's too hard, it's going to take too long. That saying it out loud just interrupts that pattern. And then I just start with one small step. So yeah, that's how
I
I
love
did.
that. It's so the declaration act of
Yes.
itself of like, I am doing this, not only is like coming from inside, but then it's also external. Like you're hearing it and you're, it's
Yep.
feeding back to you. That's, I love that
Yep.
question. Number two, if money and time and history and skills and where you live and all of that were not an issue, what would be a career or a job you might have tried?
I think I would have been a lawyer, actually. Yep. And one of the first examples of how badly I think I wanted it was I was in my early 20s. I got a ticket for riding in the carpool lane on my way to work. And I had entered the carpool lane because I needed to make a right-hand turn and there was like a ton of traffic. And I knew if I just got in there a tiny bit early, I would not get hit. So I got a ticket and I decided that I was going to fight that ticket. So I went back with my grandpa. My grandpa and I went back. We recreated the scene. I took measurements. I had penal codes. I built, and I was like, I'm fighting this ticket. So I built what I called the evidence board. It was a whiteboard, right? And I, so you go to traffic court, you sit in there if you're going to fight a ticket. So that's what I did. And I had my evidence board and I remember the bailiff coming over and asking me if I needed an easel for my board. And I said, yes, I think I do. So I was totally prepared. My grandpa sat with me at traffic court for 8 hours. Okay. Cause you show up to traffic court. You don't know when you're going to get your turn to kind of fight your case. And this was like a $150 ticket. Like this was not a lot of money, but it was the principal. So I had my easel, I had a pointer, you know, little pointer. And so my case gets called up and I was ready to go. And the police officer didn't show. So my ticket was dismissed. And I was like, I cannot believe I did all this and I was prepared. So I would have been an attorney. I think I would have been a good one. My easel and my evidence board.
I love it. Oh my gosh. Okay. Final question. What is a way when life gets chaotic that you reset or recharge just to kind of bring your energy back?
Yeah. I run, you know, and I, when I was in my younger years, I think I ran a lot to escape things, to be honest with you. And whether those things were physical challenges, emotional challenges, times where I just felt like I needed to escape, like I would just run and I ran. And, but I've, the relationship I have with running now is it's me, it's my time. And I don't have to be anybody for, I don't have to be anything to anybody. I don't have to talk. I don't have to think. I don't owe anybody an explanation. And so when I feel like I need to find myself and get back to just a center that feels peaceful and grounded and about me, I run. And that's where I find it.
That's great. Do you run with music, nothing, podcasts? How do you run?
It depends. Usually I run with music. If I'm running, you know, outdoors and then you get to a certain age where it's like, I'm a danger to myself on a good day. So running outside is like terrifying because I'm clumsy. And also I can't hear really well. So I have to like keep the music a little bit low and usually only run with like one AirPod in so that I can hear cars coming behind me. But I do like to run with music. If I'm running at home on the treadmill, I like to watch shows. So I watch all my fun shows. All my Bravo, I'm a big Bravo TV fan. So I watch all my Bravo shows. I love it.
That's great.
Yeah.
I live in Boston. My husband is a runner and this has been a snowy, icy time this year. And so his winter and running was not what he thought it would be. So the treadmill and his shows get a lot of time.
Which is fine. And you know, what's funny about this is when my kids were younger, even, you know, before I divorced, after the divorce, if I didn't run a couple of days, you know, if they noticed like, hey, I wasn't running, they could see that I was physically different. Right. And I was emotionally, physically, who they saw as their mom was different. And I remember my boys would come to me and go, hey, you think you maybe need to take a run? We call it taking a run. You think maybe you need to take a run? I was like, what are you talking about?
Oh God.
Yeah, I think you need to take a run.
Yeah.
Cause they could see like,
That's a gift, right? The people,
it is a
the
gift.
People who can observe you can see that you've got some edges and be like,
like love
I
you,
love
help
you.
You, help yourself. I
Go
love you.
Go outside. Go take
I
a
love
run.
You.
Go
Let,
downstairs.
Yeah. I love you. Let me help you help yourself.
Yes. Good. Angela, thank you so much for this conversation. How, tell people about how they can learn more about you, your book, your Substack, and learn more about, again, the this book that I loved when I said it was like part memoir, part manifesto. I think for so many women midlife, there is little vignettes, experts talking, shared stories, one page after another was just really relatable and enjoyable. I'm so glad I got to read it. So tell people how they can too.
Well, thank you so much. You can find my book, Real Girl's Guide to Midlife, on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, all the places that you love to buy books. My Substack is realgirlsguidetomidlife.com. I write about two or three times a week. So that's still a lot of fun for me. And you can find me on my website at realgirlsguide.com. Plus, I'm on the socials. Socials are so like, I'm so awkward on platforms like Instagram, but I'm there at Real Girls Guide 55 on Instagram.
Good. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to put all that in our show notes as well. So if
Thank
you're
you.
driving or you're listening to this while you're running right now, to some of my Quicksand listeners, you can find these notes later and make sure that you follow Angela. Thank you so
Thank you.
much.
Thank you for having me.
That was a fun conversation, and I've really enjoyed getting to know Angela. And I realized between having spoken to her before and reading her book, like, I probably could have talked to her for another 2 hours about so many different parts, especially of the book. We've, barely scratched the surface in terms of the content, but I promise you, it's chapter after chapter of really just insightful reflection on her part. And again, these stories from other women and the experts that she brought in to share, like, hey, what's going on right now? Chapter after chapter after chapter, and some calls to action. Gosh, I think you're going to find it inspiring. So I hope you do check it out. I'm going to give you a little spoiler alert that at the end, it's really walking you through how to create your own manifesto and your own kind of realization for what you don't have to settle for, where you can ask for and understand that you're worth more, that it's okay to not settle for enough. And if you're going to bet on somebody, bet on yourself. Thanks for being here. I hope you check out Angela's book or her Substack. And that if you're interested in more information or you know somebody else who you think I should be talking to who's going to inspire us the same way Angela did, I hope you'll reach out at quicksandpod.com and let me know. Thanks so much.